Transformation of America by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien. Chapter 12, Operation Carrier Pigeon. The term pigeon is one with which I have been familiar since the early 1980s when I first began delivering messages between my owner Senator Byrd and Puerto Rican drug lord and CIA operative, Jose Busto. Houston had simply explained to me then, as we fed the flock of pigeons roosting at the old San Juan Cathedral, that pigeons were used as messengers. The Diaz U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino often activated my pigeon programming during the hands-on mind control demonstrations. Dick Cheney further defined the term pigeon when I learned of Operation Carrier Pigeon in the mid-80s. He said, "You have been selected from the flock of programmed slaves for the carrier pigeon operation for the purpose of carrying messages from pointer to point B as ordered. Pigeons, once they fly the coop, find no freedom in flight, but carry out their task of delivering their message from pointer to point B by the shortest possible route, a direct route. I will direct your route and you will deliver messages as ordered." But no one defined my role as a pigeon more eloquently than President Reagan during the course of Operation Carrier Pigeon. The cryptic, pigeon language utilized by all participants in the operation was intermixed with The Wizard of Ounce, Alice in Wonderland, and Genie in the Bottle, cryptic programming themes. While pigeon meant messenger, carrier pigeon referred to the U.S. Air Force aircraft that actually transported the arms and drugs. Pigeon droppings included the sometimes multinational dispersal of the arms and drugs after they reached their destination. Pigeonholing meant covering up the criminal activity. These definitions, as I understood them then and understand them now, may well include deeper, more diverse meanings than I have perceived. Habib's favorite programming theme was Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, due to its international recognition and relation to the ultra-effective NASA Mirror, Time, and Infinity Space programs for instantly dissociating programmed participants. He habitually spoke in Alice in Wonderland cryptic language, and even used it for sex, as was evidenced by his twiddle-dee and twiddle-dum brutal games of perversion. Due to Habib's orchestration of Operation Carrier Pigeon, this CIA covert operation was littered with Wonderland Mirror themes from beginning to end. My CIA handler, Alex Houston, had just returned from a brief solo trip to Florida with an elaborately wrapped box. "It's from a friend of yours," he told me as he handed me the box. "Let's go into the bedroom so you can unwrap it and see it through the looking glass." Cryptically triggered, I mechanically walked to the bedroom as ordered. I removed the silver metallic bound wrappings from the box and found an expensive, elegant dress made of an unusual shimmery silver fabric. A sheet of plain white stationery written in Philip Habib's recognizable shaded blue script lay on top of the dress. It read, "The heat you radiated when we last met melted my mirror. I had it made into a dress just for you, cut to accentuate your figure so that when you melt into it, you lose yourself into the pool of liquid mirror. Step into the looking glass, sink deep within its pool and straddle dimensions in time. I'll see you there. Along with my friends." It was signed, passionately, Phil Habib, with his name written upside down under a line as though it were a mirror reflection. Houston knew there would be a note, and ordered, "Let me see your note," snatching it from my hands. He gestured toward the dress. "Go ahead and try it on while I read this note. Now let's see, what does it say? Come to Papa." I took the dress from the box. It did not feel like anything I'd ever felt before. It was cold like satin, but thin like silk. I started crying quietly, afraid that Habib would somehow show up if I had it on. "Put it on and I will zip you in," Houston said as he took another note from his wallet and read it as I undressed. "There's a pair of magic shoes to wear with your dress, something enlightening, to transport you faster than the all ruby slipper zunes. The shoes, like the dress, are made just for you, and when you wear them you'll be fit for a king. I'll send them for you at the appropriate time." Houston tucked the note back in his wallet. "See? You're not going anywhere now. You'll meet him at the White House when you have shoes to wear with it. Just slip it on. I did. Houston accessed Habib's Wonderland brutal sex programming for his own gratification. Afterwards, I hung the dress in Kelly's closet with my other trigger significant clothes, out of sight, out of mind. Until the shoes arrived. Habib sent the shoes for me, soon afterward. They were shiny black with what appeared to be silver lightning bolts down the high heels and sides. In place of dinner that night, Houston gave me a Wonderland wafer, and maxed CIA designer drug ecstasy. The wafer, like all those supplied by Habib, bore his trademark that read, "Eat me." I began to prepare for the night out as instructed. Houston zipped me into the dress, and turned me to face the mirror. As I slipped into the shoes, Houston took another note from Habib out of his pocket and read, "Something enlightening to transport you faster than the all ruby slippers. Click your heels together." I obeyed, and be there in a snap. Electrifying with the rumble of thunder. Boiling through time so you won't be late for a very important date. Houston hit me with his stun gun and I passed out. He then drove me to the Nashville airport where I boarded a small plane to Washington, D.C. I found myself at the White House with Byrd, attending another small cocktail party of about 20 to 30 people. After we spoke with Reagan, Byrd pointed me in the direction of Philip Habib and sent me over to him. My eyes were locked on Habib's as he hypnotically said, "Melt into your melted mirror for an electrifying ride. Look deep into the black of my melting mirror eyes, see you reflecting me, reflecting you, reflecting me until we melt together and sink deep into the other side." Habib took me to a quieter spot in an adjoining room and held up another Wonderland wafer as he said in Alice in Wonderland cryptic, "Welcome to Wonderland, kitten. This is a very important date. I haven't time to explain." He gave me the wafer and continued, "Eat it, and I'll take you through the door." Habib took me by the hand and led me to the doorway of another room. It was a dining room of sorts where an informal array of guests was gathered. As soon as Habib appeared in the doorway, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia quickly excused himself from the table and approached. He was wearing a multicolored robe and headwear with a black-brown rope band. I was instantly repulsed by his wicked, lecherous gaze. I stepped back into the other room in fear. Habib introduced him, "This is one of my friends I mentioned in my letter." I robotically responded, "It's a pleasure to meet you," and extended my hand as taught in charm school. Fahd bent over to kiss my hand. As he did, his evil black eyes bore into mine as he softly said, "Your beauty warms my embers. See them glowing deep within the darkness of my eyes, igniting into flame black flame." He laughed wickedly at the effect of his use of NASA hypnotic conditioning. Habib slapped him on the shoulder as though they knew each other well and there were no formalities between them and asked, "Am I right? Is that fit for a king?" Apostrophe. The three of us went into another room that appeared to be a guest bedroom that Habib was occupying. He closed the door and told me, "Diplomatic relations are very important. You know the old saying, when in Rome do as Romans do. Well, he's a king. Get on your knees. His wish is your command. Satisfy his deepest wishes. It's your turn for a magic carpet ride, so turn your genie free." Fahd was sitting in a chair by a coffee table. As I knelt on the carpet in front of him, his piercing black eyes seemed to stab into my brain like swords. I could not turn away. He stroked my neck with his index finger, "Activating oral sex programming. I have heard about you and am intent on having you." Somehow he found the slit in his robes and parted it as he continued, "Come into my tent. A feast has been spread for you." He spread his legs and exposed his penis, one of the nastiest I had ever seen, like a black night crawler worm that smelled and tasted strongly of spice. Habib watched as I carried out my orders, much to the pleasure of Fahd. Then Habib went to the chest of drawers and began pulling out his electric prod and bondage equipment as he explained, Now let me introduce you to my other friend. I need to bottle up a message with your genie and send it out to sea. You know what to do. Begin undressing now. I did as I was told and lay on my stomach on the bed while Habib sodomized me. He used his electric prod equipment and programmed me with a message to deliver to General Manuel Noriega while on an upcoming NCL cruise. I was at sea on board an NCL cruise ship bound for their private island in the Bahamas, Stirrup Cay, which was to be my rendezvous point with Noriega. Bottled up, in my mind through the recent genie in the bottle programming, was a cryptic message from King Fahd to Noriega. It was a moonless night whereby the Caribbean waters appeared as black as the night. I could not distinguish the sky from the sea in accordance with NASA hypnotic conditioning. T gazed, totally entranced, from the rear of the cruise ship. Houston used the opportunity to hypnotically enhance Habib's previous programming, while traumatizing me with the threat of being thrown overboard. The thought of treading water in the inky blackness while the lights of the ship fade further and further away until all is black and I sink to the depths of the sea, did not seem so horrible in light of the fact that I was to be the bearer of bad news to Noriega in the morning. Upon arrival to NCL's Stirrup Cay, Houston and I began our usual walking trek to the farthest end of the island where the CIA operations radio station and equipment were located. In a hidden cove on the island's backside was a smaller island of sufficient size to conceal Noriega's personal yacht, anchored behind it. As Houston and I made our way along the cove's beach, we came upon an old wooden boat half buried in the sand and a man sitting beside it. Because I was in a different personality, I did not recognize the man as my contact who ran the Stirrup Cay control lower for drug trafficking and covert activity. I asked him how he got there. He began his charade, which, due to the depths of my trance, I believed in its literal text, while Houston heard quite a different story. I shipwrecked. John, the name I called him, pointed to the boat half buried in the sand, that's all that is left of my boat. I asked, why haven't you been rescued? He cryptically replied, I sent a message in a bottle and I expect a response real soon. Good thing I had these coconuts, he was carving one, and all that sugar in the hull to sustain me. Houston laughed, immediately realizing that sugar meant cocaine and said, surprised, in the hull? As he bent down to look inside the wreck. I looked, too. There was more white cocaine and dark cocaine paste than I could mule, carry. In one walking haul, even with both of my tote bags full. But I could not comprehend reality in the midst of this charade, and therefore commented that he was fortunate that both the white and brown sugar had made it through the wreck. Houston said, so, they cast you away, huh? My contact laughed and sniffed, yeah, cast me away with all that sugar, that's nothing to sniff at. He looked up as Houston informed him a speedboat was approaching. I looked out across the cove beyond the little island and finally noticed Noriega's yacht. A black mirror, Finnish speedboat, which matched the upper smoke glass windows of Noriega's yacht, was approaching. John told me, probably has something to do with that message I sent. Help me wave him in. I did. He handed me a coconut and, using it as a scramble and excuse for me to join him on Noriega's yacht, persuaded me to board the speedboat with him. Houston stayed behind to guard the cocaine that had obviously already been delivered from Noriega's yacht. When we pulled up to the rear of the yacht, I was helped on board by Noriega's armed guards. I noticed there did not seem to be any big parties going on as was customary, and Noriega seemed unusually abrupt and businesslike. He was not drunk this time. Upon command from John, I delivered Fahd's message. I am under command to deliver a message from King Fahd. The Caribbean is becoming volatile. Trouble in Jamaica, trouble in Cuba, even trouble in Panama. Dominican Republic must be a launching point for missiles and artillery that are being channeled through Cuba. Concluding arms deal. Carrier pigeon must be detained until all transactions are cleared. Banco de Panama to receive contra aid after all steps leading to me have been swept away by the shifting sands of lime, and all pigeon droppings pigeonholed. Our business is concluded. Let us part on friendly terms. My personal perceptions of history as it happened in reality remain somewhat distorted, as I had no access to news outside of my mind-controlled environment. In order to keep my memory retrieval free of contamination, I completed the deprogramming process before educating myself through books and news. I have since learned that what was reported as news was often distorted propaganda, and many events were never reported at all. Therefore, I do not know of the troubles in Jamaica and Cuba, to which King Fahd referred. I was aware, however, that due to outside scrutiny, Houston had recently met with Jamaican officials in Kingston pertaining to ceasing the long-standing criminal covert operations. As for Cuba, I only knew that I was no longer meeting with my Cuban contact. In Panama, I knew Noriega himself was the object of controversy. The arms deal was the final stage of Operation Carrier Pigeon, where the planes were to wait in Saudi Arabia until all bank transactions were cleared and the load was ready for disbursement. Saudi Arabian King Fahd would then fund the Contras via Noriega for Reagan after all evidences had been properly covered up, just as he had done in Afghanistan. After the shipment, there would be no further deals through Noriega involving Fahd, because Noriega could no longer be trusted. Besides, Fahd had increased diplomatic relations with Mexico for covert operations, and Iran-Contra was just beginning to heat up. Noriega did not seem to be upset by the news of losing Saudi Arabian business, although he was somber and took some time to respond. His translator was working over some complex computer equipment after I delivered the message. I left Noriega's yacht with John and a brief message for Dick Cheney at the Pentagon. Back on Stirrup Cay, Houston was anxiously waiting to begin transporting the cocaine back to the party area of the island. There, NCL workers were cleaning up from the cruise ship's beach party cookout, which was NCL's excuse to stop the ship. After I mulled the first heavy load of cocaine in my tote sacks, Houston approached one worker familiar with the drug operation and informed him we had a heavier load than usual and needed to make another trip. The worker directed us to a huge empty food container used for transporting cookout supplies from the ship, and gave us the key. We locked the first load in the container, and I took my empty tote sacks, plus another straw bag back for another haul. With the second load, Houston even carried some cocaine himself. We had to run quite a distance through the island woods in an attempt to make it back to the ship's shuttle before scheduled departure time. When we arrived, the beach was nearly deserted, as all the passengers had been taken back to the ship. All that remained was the food container and the NCL worker who was hurrying us onto the shuttle and on board the ship, which was waiting for us. When the cruise ship docked at the port of Miami, Puerto Rican drug lord and CIA operative Jose Busto was acting as a U.S. immigration officer, commissioned by the Drug Enforcement Agency through the CIA, which he often did for NCL. Busto helped us clear ship undetected with a large load of cocaine. The drugs were packed into suitcases, then loaded into Houston's specially made motorhome, which was parked in NCL's guarded, restricted parking lot. Most of the cocaine was dropped off as usual at Warner Robins Air Force Base in Macon, Georgia, to be distributed to destinations unknown to me. The money generated by the sale of cocaine was supposedly used to fund a major arms shipment into Saudi Arabia. These weapons were reportedly distributed among several neighboring countries. The profits were then relayed into Reagan's Contra Corps. A large quantity of cocaine was retained by Houston for his own use and delivery for personal profit through his country music industry contacts. Some of the cocaine would be delivered by me to Saudi Arabian ambassador, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, Fahd's own homing pigeon. I carried a message from Warner Robins Air Force Base in addition to the message from Noriega agreeing to Fahd's terms back to Dick Cheney at the Pentagon. Cheney then prepared me for the final phase of the operation. This was a meeting with Prince Bunder, who Cheney, Houston, and others referred to as Sultan, in Nashville, Tennessee, where he often visited corrupt friends. There, I would relay a message of agreement to FARC's terms between Noriega and the U.S., as well as confirm all Air Force flights, carrier pigeons, and bank transactions. In turn, FARC's homing pigeon would relay the messages to FARC so that the seemingly long-running drugs for arms deals would draw to a successful conclusion. Dick Cheney cautioned me, Sultan will be in Nashville having dinner with friends at the Stockyard. The Stockyard was a popular country music dinner club known for its CIA criminal covert activity involvement. Cheney glanced at the list on his desk and continued, among others, those friends would be Mayor Fulton One and Sheriff Thomas. They are considered a threat to the operation. They're not discreet. Thomas in particular is not to be trusted. He's an ass and too crooked. So, Sultan must leave the table before the message is delivered. Any questions? Good. I certainly had no questions this time. I did not need him to caution me about Nashville's Mayor Richard Fulton, whom Houston had prostituted me to, and Sheriff Fate Thomas. I had known the pair for years, had been cautioned about them before, and had no respect for them at all. Together Thomas and Fulton had indiscreetly perpetuated the total corruption that had permeated Nashville's $2.8 billion country music industry, which ran the city of Nashville. They ran the city's business from a bar, the Stockyard, while they drank and openly used cocaine. If I had had the capacity to wonder, I would have wondered what a homing pigeon, so critical to the conclusion of this international criminal covert operation, was doing with such low-level sleaze. As it was, I could only sense relief at not having to deal with them, too. Prince Bunder bin Sultan's reputation for sex and drugs was widely known in Nashville. But much of my information pertaining to his activities came from one of my closest Project Monarch friends. She is an entertainer's daughter who was prostituted regularly to Sultan when he was in town, which was often. When Cheney was through with me, Bird escorted me to the White House to see Reagan, who also cautioned me about the prince. Reagan was aware of Habib's having activated me sexually with King Fahd, and made it clear that my scheduled rendezvous with Prince Bunder would not include the usual sex. Reagan joked in Bird's presence, Birds may well be eaten by a kitten. Reagan's pet name for me, but not homing pigeons. Homing pigeons taste foul. Burr laughed. Reagan continued, homing pigeons have one purpose. Passing messages. Throughout history, world leaders have passed messages to and from each other by way of pigeons. Messages that have set the course of events that have altered the course of history. Homing pigeons are loyal and dedicated to their task, flying overseas, yet never pausing long enough to even quench their thirst, giving no thought to their own needs. When a pigeon is released, he takes a direct course to his destination. Dedicated to delivering the very messages on which history was founded. Why, even Noah relied on a pigeon to traverse the seas to bring back a message of hope. It is your duty to attach an added message to the homing pigeon, one of peace, from our homeland Lohiz, one from the President of the United States to King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. Omitted due to international ramification. Bird was visibly inspired by the speech. I was literally saved by the bell from another boring, long-winded recitation that Reagan had just inspired in Bird when Cheney telephoned me back to his office. It was still morning and Cheney had appeared very busy, hurried, and irritable when I had seen him just a short time earlier. My heart was heavy in expectant anticipation of the physical and sexual brutality Cheney's moods normally incited. Yet I was relieved to escape the torturous, picture-painting competition that experience had taught me Bird and Reagan were about to embark on. My heart lightened when my escort left me at Cheney's office and I noticed his foul mood had changed dramatically. I understand you ordered me to report in, sir. Cheney looked up from his desk where he was shuffling through papers and tying up loose ends before leaving his office. "Sit down," he ordered. "I just got word that the genie in the bottle castaway operation is complete and I intend to pop a cork or two of my own in celebration of its successful conclusion. I have time on my hands and want you to join me. The bunkhouse is being prepared." Cheney apparently thought of something, went to the door and told the guy who had escorted me, "Make sure there's some Wonderland wafers in the bunkhouse." He walked to his desk, picked up the phone and said, "I'm outta here," into it and slammed it down. I followed Cheney out the door, and we turned to the right rather than the left outside his office and walked to his personal quarters referred to as the bunkhouse. It was decorated in Cheney's Western style in browns and tans, with leather furniture. There was no food, maybe some nuts stashed somewhere, but plenty of bottles of alcohol. I was swollen and bleeding vaginally, the bottom of my shirt was soaked in blood, and my belly hurt deep inside when my escort finally came for me early the next morning. Staying around Cheney while he slept was as deadly a mistake as removing his clothes or questioning him. It was forbidden. This time he broke his own rule, and did not even punish me for it when morning arrived. He had spent so many hours drinking alcohol and using his enormous penis as an assault weapon that he passed out shortly before my escort arrived. As I walked into the hall, I doubled over from pain. My escort turned to Cheney and remarked, "Christ, Cheney." Cheney lifted his head and proudly slurred, "Now you know why they call it Dick." Back in Tennessee, my CIA-paid gynecologist, who knew I was under mind control, covered for my abusers as usual and wrote me a prescription for swelling and pain. I was still in pain and ill from my exposure to Dick Cheney and his high-voltage torture and brutal sex when Houston drove me to Nashville's Stockyard nightclub for my rendezvous with Prince Bandar bin Sultan. A waitress led me to the Saudi Arabian ambassador's table where he was drinking with Mayor Fulton, Sheriff Thomas, and Metro Police Chief Joe Casey. Three, I approached him and said, "If you please, Sir Ounce, I am under command to deliver a message to you from the Pentagon. There is to be no horseplay, sex games. We must get down to business." There was laughter from everyone at the table. I continued, "My message is brief and I only need a moment of your time away from your dinner." The prince's face grew more serious and we left the table. He touched the waitress, arm and she pointed to a door across the hall that led to an empty room. We stood just inside the room, and I quickly delivered Ray Pigeon cryptic message. "The carrier pigeon, Air Force airplane, will take flight. And will keep its promise, the agreed load, while all transactions, both bank and distribution, are procured through the designated diplomatic channels, Habib. Your bonus, 1 crystal, 3 cuts await you. The President of the United States gives his word to King Fahd. He told me his driver would meet me out from of the stockyard and instructed me to put the cocaine in the back. I left the building to rejoin Houston at the car in order that the cocaine could be delivered. A white stretch limousine was pulled up in front of the stockyard. Chief Casey's assigned Metro police officers guarded the area, and the cocaine was transferred into the back seat of the prince's limo. Houston and I immediately left the area. My part in Operation Carrier Pigeon was concluded. 1. Richard Fulton and his bank were under federal investigation as of 1991. 2. Faye Thomas is currently serving time in a federal penitentiary for bribery and extortion. 3. Recently under federal investigation for corruption.